The reinvention of the one-room schoolhouse will have big implications for your family, your school district, and our society. Today, I had the opportunity to interview Rhonda Fonseca, a school teacher of 20 years who decided to open her small, own private school as a micro school for struggling middle school students on the island of Maui in Hawaii. Join me as we listen to her story and then discuss overall the phenomenon of micro schooling in the United States and around the world as it gains traction. This is Lectures on Learning, and I'm your host, Heather Clayton Staker. Welcome, my friends. When I ask you to picture a one-room schoolhouse, meaning a mixed-age classroom with a single teacher in a single classroom, you likely picture an old black and white photograph from colonial America. Maybe it had a dusty road leading up to a brick building or a clapboard building or a log cabin even. Perhaps there's a post out in front that a horse is tied to. You open the door and inside you see the chalkboard. You see the school teacher, maybe with a bun and a long skirt on. You see the rows of desks and chairs. That is the quintessential, iconic one-room schoolhouse that we're familiar with because it was the predominant way that K-12 children experienced learning and went to school. It was the main model for classrooms for a long time, really until the Industrial Revolution and the exposure to the Prussian model and the factory model that our schools are more based on today. And the other thing that unlocked a change for schools was the invention of the school bus. And that school bus was able to take students farther away. And that one-room schoolhouse, hyper-local, became a thing mostly of the past. In 1930, there were about 150,000 one-room schoolhouses left. By 2005, there were fewer than 400, according to NPR. And so that phenomenon had really receded into the history books and the old black and white photographs. But the interesting thing is that it is experiencing a resurgence in the form of microschooling. Today, I'm going to interview Rhonda Fonseca, a teacher of 20 years. She started at a Catholic school and then decided that she needed something different for her own children as they approached middle school and for other children in her neighborhood. I'm on the island of Maui in the state of Hawaii, and we are meeting today with Rhonda to hear her story. Afterwards, I will tell you how what she did 15 years ago was a precursor to a huge phenomenon that's unfolding right now in education around the world. So stick with me after the interview and we'll analyze a bit how this is indicative of a broader societal phenomenon. So here's Rhonda. Rhonda, it's so good to meet you. Thank you for your time today.
You're welcome.
It's really a pleasure to meet you. So I've heard all about you and that you were brave enough to leave your school where you're teaching and start your own small school out of your garage here in Maui. Tell me a little bit about why you chose to do that. First of all, where were you teaching before you made that decision?
I was teaching at a Catholic school,
okay,
even though I'm not Catholic. And my oldest son was going to be in seventh grade. And I decided that the public school was not the place for him for middle school. I know that age is really critical. And I had several other parents leaving at the elementary school and wanting to have an alternative for their child for the middle school years. So they were telling me all the time, asking me, can you do it? And I thought, well, I'm a certified teacher. I can do it.
What grade were you teaching at the Catholic school?
Sixth grade.
And what, do you have a specialty in what you were?
No, it was sixth grade, everything. There, the sixth grade was still in the elementary school.
Okay.
So here in Hawaii, that middle school is sixth, seventh, and eighth grade, but at the Catholic school, it was up to sixth grade. So we had to figure out what are we going to do for seventh and eighth grade.
And how long have you been teaching in the classroom at this point?
Oh, wow. By that time, I'd been teaching probably 20 years.
20 years.
But not at that school.
Uh-huh. But they've been traditional classrooms for the most part.
Very traditional.
So what was a typical day like as a teacher in those settings before you left?
I taught reading, writing, and math, and then another teacher taught the other. And so we would switch classes. I would have the kids for 45 minutes, and then they'd be gone, and switching back and forth. So
you'd prepare your lessons, deliver the lessons, grade homework,
just like your typical traditional teaching. Yes.
So talk to me about, so you had the son going to the seventh grade, mm-hmm. and you also heard from other parents that they were concerned about sending their students to the traditional classroom environment for middle school.
Right.
What were some of the concerns?
The concerns were that the schools are large, the kids are going through puberty, they're having, you know, issues with who they are and what they're doing. So putting them in a situation where they were at one in 1,000 here in Hawaii in the middle schools was not something that they wanted to do for their child. And I didn't want to do for my child.
What were the academics like? Were there pretty good options in terms of at least getting a decent academic education?
In the public school?
Uh-huh.
The middle schools really struggle.
Yeah.
Very much so. So no, I would say it would not have been the best academic environment.
What do you think were the reasons for that struggle in the middle schools?
I think a lot of it is the schools here are, the middle schools are huge. For some reason, that's where they put everybody when that's the age when they should actually be in smaller settings, smaller classrooms with fewer kids, a better teacher-student ratio.
So what first gave you the idea to do something different?
I think it was just parents asking me, what do I do? What do I do? Where should they go? How should I, you know, what do you suggest? And I didn't have any answers for them. I thought, I don't know what I'm going to do with my own child. So, and at that time, there was not the online school. There was homeschooling, but it was not considered professional. It was thought of as, you know, the kids that their parents never even did anything. They just stayed home. So it wasn't the more structured that it is now, that or the online things that are available now. So
did you consider, though, just straight up homeschooling for middle school?
No.
No. So how did you find that in between where you thought, I'm going to bring other families in and teach multiple students?
Because I still also believe that kids need the socialization. They need to be able to work and learn to work cooperatively and work in pairs and work in small groups and also receive the individual instructions. So I wanted that my own children to have that as well, because I don't believe just one-on-one all day by yourself is healthy either.
So you thought, did it just come to you? You just thought, I'm going to start my own small school.
I just was like, okay, I can do this. I can do it.
And what did your husband think when you told him?
He thought it was crazy, but he supported it 100%. And then when he, you know, all the parents that were coming up to me and saying, we would love to put our kids with you. And I was like, okay, let me see if I can make this work.
So tell me about your vision for that school. What were you thinking? This is how I would run that school.
I wanted it to be more experiential. I think that's super important. And so I thought, what can I do where the kids, everything that I do is real life or can apply to real life, and I can give them more. So I did major academics in the morning for 2 hours, and then I did project-based learning. We went on hikes. One thing that happened is on a hike is there were crawfish, and I didn't even know we had crawfish in Hawaii, and we found crawfish, and the kids were like, can we take them back? And I was like, no, we're not taking them out of here. And they said, no, we'll get a tank, and we'll do this, and we'll learn about them, and we'll study them. And so we did. We brought the crawfish back. The kids went on and found out and did all the research and found out how to take care of a crawfish. We saw the whole process of the life cycle. I didn't even know they molted. I mean, and it all came from the kids.
So we're the first cloth pet of crawfish, at least in Hawaii.
I know.
That's funny.
Who would have thought? But yeah, so things like that, that I wanted to be able to do. And like cooking, you know, they every Friday, two kids were responsible for cooking a meal, and they had to budget for the meal. Everybody paid $5, so they had to stay within their budget. We went to the grocery store. They had to do all of that. So that was all part of it.
Are you a cook?
Not that great, but I had a parent volunteer that would come on Fridays and help. That it was always two students that were responsible. We assigned a week, and they had to take care of it, and then the parent would help.
So you found things that you were good at and then supplemented with parents when
needed, yeah.
Uh-huh. So what was your first step? So you thought, I'm going to build the school, I'm going to recruit the neighbors. What did you do first?
First, I had a meeting with anyone who was interested, the families that were interested, and they were just super, super supportive. And they said, whatever you need and however much you want us to pay you. And I didn't want it to be any more than, I wanted it to be super affordable, which that's what part bothered my husband. He was like, what you're doing with these kids, they should be paying you a whole lot more. And I said, no, that's not what I why I'm doing it. So, but anyway, that was the first step. And then finding a location.
And how did you find a location? How did you go about that?
I just started asking around if anyone knew of any place that was available. And one of the parents whose daughter they wanted in my class kind of got on her. She's a mortgage broker. And so she found somewhat inexpensive place to rent that was, so we went and checked it out, and it was a great spot.
What was it? It was a house?
It was a house.
Okay. And so what were you looking for in that space?
One very large room for sure was basically what I wanted. One very large room. And then the first one, we had it downstairs as well.
And then how did you arrange the furniture in that large room?
I just bought a bunch of tables at Costco and chairs, and they had tables. And I bought a whiteboard, a giant whiteboard, and put it up. And the first one was, the house was kind of junk, and the parents all came together, and they painted it for me. And we did a big get-the-house-ready party because it was kind of needed a little help.
So in terms of your budget, how many students were you able to recruit that first year?
The first year I had nine.
Nine students, and they were all seventh and eighth graders.
Mm-hmm.
Were they mixed boys and girls?
Mixed boys and girls, yes.
And how much did you charge? So this was 15 years ago.
15 years ago, I think the first year I charged $5,000 for the year.
$5,000 for the full year. And then roughly how much of that revenue was eaten up with your facility costs?
Probably about half. With facilities, books, everything that I purchased for this school.
Okay. And then you were able to pocket about half of that.
Mm-hmm.
And then is that your setup for the full? So you did this for 3 years.
I did it for 4 years.
4 years.
So my oldest son was in seventh and eighth grade. And then when he went to ninth grade, my next son was in seventh grade. So I did it for him as well, seventh and eighth grade.
Mm-hmm. And nine students, he said.
The first year, nine. The second year, I had 13.
Oh, wow.
I had more. And then the following year, I had 10. I think I had 10 the last 2 years.
Okay. So your budget was $45,000.
I charged $6,000.
So it climbed up a little bit.
Yeah.
Got up to $60,000,
$70,000.
So what did you think about that facility? Did you stay in that house the whole 4 years?
No. I stayed there the first 2 years. And then I realized that my garage, which is detached, would be big enough, and it would make it a little more. At first, I didn't want the school in my house because I wanted that separation of my home versus where I work. And then I thought, well, it might be really convenient, and it actually ended up being much better when I was up here in my own home.
Why was that?
Because I knew where everything was. Everything was easy. I could also write off financially the house as for the taxes that I had to pay. And just knowing the neighborhood and having a big backyard, a place for the kids to play, everything was a little more
easy. This is definitely a big, beautiful backyard. Definitely, I can see why you chose this spot.
Thank you.
So tell me then about, let's talk about the 2 hours that you said you were just doing focused academics. How did you do that? So you had seventh and eighth graders. They were probably at mixed levels with where they came from. How did you teach all of them at the same time?
Well, for language arts, I used novels. So it didn't really matter whether they were a seventh grader or an eighth grader. So I did a lot of novel studies and I did a lot of essay writing, that kind of thing. So I didn't direct it for seventh or eighth grade. I just did generic. And then for math, I did, I tested them and it depended on where they were at. And some of them were in pre-algebra, some were even in algebra one in eighth grade. So I just got them a textbook at their level and I did, individual walking around teaching for that. Couldn't do whole group because they were all in different places.
So you would cluster them a bit based on their level and then do spot lessons right. for each group
for each.
And try to get that into your... And so
yeah.
did you try to do... say an hour of English language arts and an hour of math?
Mm-hmm. Okay. I tried. That's basically how it was structured.
Okay. And did you do any social studies and science? Or
all the social studies and science was mixed in with whatever project-based thing they were doing. We did actually a lot of science because we ended up doing a garden and the crawfish thing and all, hiking, surfing. They wanted to know what about the waves? How does that work? And so we did a lot of that kind of thing.
Did any of them want to learn something that you weren't able to teach them? Any of them want to learn a language or was there ever that situation?
Not that I know.
How did it feel teaching all of them for 2 hours when they were at different levels?
It was tiring. It was. But the kids that were in there were very motivated kids. I didn't have a lot of issues with not wanting to do anything. So that part was easy, I would say. But it was, just like when you have a full classroom in every different level, you're spread pretty thin. But it was easier with 10 versus 20 or 25 in a regular classroom.
What do you do to differentiate so successfully? So you said that you relied on those formative assessments to figure out what level to put them in. Mm-hmm. Were there other strategies that you used to differentiate?
I knew most of the kids because I taught a lot of them already, so I was aware of where they were. I did have them do standardized testing when they were with me. So we did do that. And then I just would use whatever, testing materials that I had that I had to get stuff online, actually, a lot of the stuff.
Did you ever sleep?
I did. I loved it, though.
Yeah. Because it seems like putting together your lessons and then
it was hard.
Differentiating for each of them and then planning these interesting projects.
And then, but with project-based learning, if you do all the setup, the kids are the ones that are doing the work. You're just providing the outline and the method. Here's how you go about finding that information. Mm-hmm. So that...
Education is changing, and you can lead the way. The Guide School Kickoff Course trains teachers to become AI-powered guides in flexible, student-led classrooms. Empower your students and transform your role. Start now at guide.school/kickoff. See you there.
That's the part I loved.
Were there any individuals whose lives you felt you could see were changed for the better as a result of coming to your small middle school? What did you call it?
It was the Achievement Academy.
The Achievement Academy. Did you see any grand achievement as a result of coming to the Achievement Academy or any just more social, emotional well-being that was the result of it?
I did. I had one child in particular whose parents were going through a really bad divorce. She was super emotional, had several issues with her father, and things were difficult for her. So it was nice for her to be in that small supportive group. She was, but she ended up, and she was a runner, and so we did cross country. So she was still able to participate in cross country and do that kind of thing.
How was she able to do that?
They allowed us to to participate.
Okay. So she would leave after school, after Achievement Academy, and go to the middle school cross country team. Mm-hmm. And that worked out with the schedule okay?
It worked out fine.
So you felt like it was, how was it supportive for her? What were you able to do with her that you weren't able to do at the Catholic school with a larger group?
Well, because she needed, she would often just break into tears and would need to be, you know, put off on her own, or one of her parents would text her at school, and then she would have a little meltdown. And so she was able to have that time where she needed to collect herself. And then they were like, the kids in there were like brothers and sisters. Like they would harass each other and tease each other and also be there for each other.
So you talk about this brother and sister rapport. What was it about that group that allowed for that rapport that you weren't able to see in your 20 years prior in a more traditional classroom environment?
I think in a more traditional, you're confined to what you can say, how, you know, you have to get this done in this amount of time. And in your own, you can structure it, or if something comes up, you can stop everything and have a little mini therapy session as a group and offer that to each other. Whereas you can't do that in the regular classroom.
You're more beholden to the clock and to getting
the clock and to getting things done. And like I said, what you can say and how, what's okay and what's not okay to say. So, yeah.
What advice would you have to another adult who wanted to set up a micro school and wasn't particularly confident in their ability to be that support? How do you become like that, the person that knows what to say and how to host the mini therapy session? Was that intuitive to you, or did you learn?
I think it's intuitive as a parent. Having been a teacher, but I think it's intuitive. I think, you know, it's just like anything. There's people that you meet that you know are a good teacher or would be a good teacher because of their personality. And then there's people that have doctorate degrees that have no business being teachers. It doesn't matter how much education. You just need to be a person that's a compassionate, empathetic kind of person to be able to do that.
Were there particular routines or practices that you put into place to create that kind of loving, supportive unity?
Well, we did set up, you know, just like when you set up in a regular classroom, you talk about what's okay, what's not okay, and treating each other with kindness and that sort of thing, and just modeling that, always being that way with the kids, treating them with respect, treating them like I would want them to treat me. That, and when they model that behavior to each other, just making it become, that's important. Look at that. Look how that is.
How did you incentivize that? Was it by calling them out as they modeled that behavior? Or you would?
Yes. And I can, you know, and that's that kind of setting. I can also say what you just said was wrong and you shouldn't be saying that. You need to apologize, you know, because you can call them out in a different than if you're in the classroom. There's a certain way you have to do it. But, you know,
it felt more like a family in that way.
Yeah, it just felt like a family. So it was okay to say those things. And of course, in a very respectful way, but yes.
Did you have behavior challenges that you felt were difficult?
In my last year, I did, because I allowed a child to come to the school that I didn't know. Typically, I knew most of had, or somebody else knew them, but someone had heard about the school and had asked for their child to come in, and it was a challenge.
Did you endure the whole year, or did you part ways?
I did have to part ways, actually.
You did, yeah. Just wasn't a fit.
It just didn't work.
So do you think pre-screening is a crucial part of the method? You have to sort of make sure it's a good fit with each student and family?
I do. I think that's important. And just knowing that if it doesn't work, that it's okay to part ways.
Say it's not a fit.
Yeah, it was the hardest. That was actually the hardest thing. I really struggled with that,
mm-hmm.
because I wanted to help this child.
Let's talk about the project-based learning. So where did you come up with your ideas?
You're not even going to believe this. At the time, The Apprentice was on.
With Donald Trump.
With Donald Trump. It was my favorite show. I loved watching that because that's something I love to do is like, how do you come up with this marketing scheme for this? You know, so I watched it and I thought, oh my gosh, those are fun. Those would be great ideas. So
I stole your ideas from The Apprentice and Donald Trump.
A lot of them from The Apprentice. And then we set up this whole thing in the class where there was a competition. No one got voted out. There was no, you're fired.
You're fired.
I did set up the point system to, you know, for all the little projects that we did. But we did things like, you know, I put different random products on a piece of paper and they had to pull a name and then they had to come and go and make a commercial for it and come up with a song and a jingle and, you know, do the whole thing. And yeah. And then we rated it and they got a certain amount of points if they did well with it.
That is wonderful. I've never heard that answer before. So can you thinking back, were there elements of it that you felt like were less successful than your 20 years in the traditional environment?
No.
Not what I'm saying.
I know. I'm trying to think.
What do you miss about it then? So you're now back in a traditional setting. After 4 years, you went back. You wanted the retirement pension.
I had to do it per retirement.
For the pension. So what do you miss then?
I miss the flexibility of being able to do on-the-spot thinking and, you know, like the crawfish, something like that happens and you can just immediately turn it into something without having to pre-plan. It comes from the kids. It comes from them. I miss that. I mean, 1 year we did a field trip and our field trip was to go to the mainland and we did Yellowstone and we did Yosemite and we did Grand Tetons. We did a national park tour and just having that ability to have them experience that. I mean, kids in here never seen snow. So, you know, so many of them saw snow for the first time with us. I mean, just that flexibility and that spontaneity of being able to do that.
What advice do you have for another teacher or parent that wanted to start this kind of it's almost a neighborhood co-op in the way the parents helped you, but it's also a micro school in the sense that it really was one teacher, mixed age cohort,
uh-huh.
And you were able to run that one room schoolhouse. What advice do you have?
I think nowadays with the online capabilities that you can find and that are available, it would be actually quite simple to do that because your hardcore academics could be done online, differentiated already. So nobody has to do that for you, which I think requires skill. And maybe just talking to different people about what are some of the things in the area where you live that you could do your projects on and have a structure for what you wanted that other time to be and whether you wanted it to be, you know, individual or partners or small group and have all that kind of pre-planned. And you can find those resources now online. And so it would be, if you had the people to do it, you really wouldn't need a certified teacher to make it happen, which I think is awesome.
It's fascinating to me that in the modern, what we call flex micro schools that are using the software for the academics in the morning and then spending the rest of the afternoon out in the sun climbing Haleakala,
right,
that they are spending 2 hours also on core academics, roughly speaking. So it's interesting that you, in the analog environment, found that was about the time you needed to really
hit it. Yeah, because with project-based learning, they have to have certain skills to be able then to go and do that project. So you do have to have core teaching, you know. So I agree, core teaching still needs to be done, but I think 2 hours is, that's all I did. And then the rest, they were still learning, but they were learning doing their own thing and coming from them and doing what they love. And it was fun. The one thing my son said when he went to high school was like, Mom, this is awful. It's so boring. And that was so hard for him to make that transition to public school after I stopped, because he had he thought learning was fun, which is what it should be. And in a situation like that, it can be fun. It should be fun.
Looking back on it now, what are you most grateful for from that experience?
I'm grateful for the time that I was able to have with those kids, my kids as well, and the creativity. And I can use some of that in my classroom now, but not nearly to the extent that I... And when I did it, I was like, oh, I'm so exhausted. I can't wait to go back to public schools and not have to work so hard. And then I was like, oh, but I really do. But still, it was a very, very...
almost liberating,
fulfilling, very fulfilling time.
So it sounds like it was fulfilling. It was the students, the time to be able to support them.
Mm-hmm. It was. It was a very, like I said, that those years are awful years when you feel weird about yourself. You just don't, you know. And that was a great time to be for them to. They could be silly. They could say whatever they wanted, and nobody was going to tease them. And yeah, it was.
And what were their results? Were they able to stay on pace with mm-hmm. their peers at the middle school?
Mm-hmm. They did really well, actually. More than half went on to the hardest school here in Maui to get into, a private school.
And they were they able to reintegrate into a more traditional setting?
Yeah, but like I said, depending, it was a little harder for some than others just to get used to it.
Mm-hmm.
My son being one of them.
Well, Rhonda, that I've learned so much from you. Thank you so much for your time today and for sharing the story and for your courage to do something unusual 15 years ago that was trailblazing. And now who would have thought that so many people would be trying to follow this kind of model? So thank you again for your time.
Good. Well, I hope it helps, and I could help. If I could give advice, I would be willing to do that for other people.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I really enjoyed talking to Miss Rhonda, and I invite you to stick with me now for a minute while we analyze that conversation. If you are listening to this via podcast, you might want to go to the YouTube channel because we have pictures that show Miss Rhonda's cute classroom when it was at the house and then at her detached garage. But let's think for a minute about what we heard. So she described leaving her Catholic school of 20 years to set up a school in a small setting with just a handful of middle school students so that she could help them get through those years with more success and more emotional well-being. And she talked about how she misses it. There were some real freedoms and ability to connect with those students and support those students and just be creative that she misses now as she's back in a more traditional environment. The reason her story is so compelling for us now, though, is that before there were hundreds of thousands of one-room schoolhouses around the United States. And then that number receded as schools found that it was hard to have that subject matter expertise to allow for a broad range of subjects. And so with the invention of the school bus, it became more and more desirable for families to put their children on the bus to attend a large comprehensive school where they could have all sorts of subjects and classes and courses and have hopefully a higher standard of education than they might get in a one-room schoolhouse with a single teacher and be beholden to that one teacher's level of expertise. Today, one of the constraints on returning to the one-room schoolhouse model is that it's hard to find adults who are as capable as Rhonda. So you heard Rhonda describe how she was able to do formative assessments, determine the students' level of learning, put them into the right math and English classes based on where they were, and then run their 2 hours of academics, hurrying from group to group to give small group instruction to each cluster of students based on their ability. And then she was able to dream up afternoon projects for them based on what they wanted to learn for science and social studies. And so she really showed a lot of expertise in her ability to do that. And even then, there were probably some students who had to wait their turn as she was trying to shuffle around her small classroom to meet each of their needs.
And that points to why the one-room schoolhouse did not endure, that the comprehensive school combined with the school bus became a better option. But today we're seeing a revolution, the return of the one-room schoolhouse with this new vehicle called the micro school. And a micro school is like that one room schoolhouse in the sense that it's mixed age cohorts and it's small. The change is that the instructional component is often done differently. Stepping back, there are three pillars to what it takes to put together a one room schoolhouse or a micro school. The first is a physical facility, some kind of a school to meet in. The second is the human component, the systems and the culture and the friendships that bring together the community. And then the third is the instructional piece. So how does a micro school stack up compared to a traditional classroom? And let's think about how it's different from a traditional classroom and why current technologies are enabling a flowering of micro schooling. Let's think first about the physical facility. So one of the attractions to a large comprehensive school is the football stadium, the tennis courts, the swimming pool, the theater, the big features of a facility that allow for that kind of grand gathering of students. But there are disadvantages as well. So some of the disadvantages that are increasingly toxic for our children include safety problems, everything ranging from the fear of gun violence to the microbullying that can happen at school and go unnoticed because it's a big facility with a lot of students. We sometimes worry about the adequacy of the food that's prepared in large institutions where it's brought in on a semi-truck. And a micro school offers the opportunity for a small kitchen with more locally produced and locally assembled food. We also worry about the distances. So the school bus takes a long time. And some families like the idea of a hyper-local school where their students can just walk or scooter down the street to attend school. So those are reasons why the physical facility of a small micro school is on the radar of parents and communities. There's some attraction to it. And that was amplified during the COVID pandemic, clearly, when so many families were worried about sending their children to a big institutional setting, and they preferred a learning pod with just a few families where they could keep aware of the health of the students in the community, and it just wasn't such a big, contagious place to send their children. So those are some of the reasons why this physical setup of a micro school can be a drawback. It doesn't necessarily have the big stadiums, but it also can be a benefit. Safety and food and exercise and light and some of the things that can be available in a smaller setting without the big fluorescent lamps. One note, though, is that interestingly, some of the micro schools are starting to find ways to become as good, if not better, on the sports equation. And that is, for example, the elite soccer teams or the elite ski teams that are forming micro schools so that their students can learn efficiently in small groups and then spend the rest of the afternoon on the slope skiing or on the soccer field practicing. So we're actually seeing some examples of sports becoming even better among micro school students because they have more time. And so they'll spend a few hours doing their academics and then the rest of the day is spent on their Olympic level sport. And that's an interesting thing to watch when it comes to that pro and con with micro schooling. The second pillar of micro schooling and one room schoolhouses is the human connection. And so some parents feel like the large comprehensive schools with the hundreds or even thousands of students are attractive. They want their students to be in that larger world, a larger campus with all of those associations. Meanwhile, other parents and community members are starting to be attracted to the micro school or the one-room schoolhouse again, because we see a troubling uptick in mental health problems among our children. And we suspect and observe that children that are in tighter family-like communities that put a priority on relationships and support offer something beneficial that our comprehensive large schools struggle to replicate. I talked to a superintendent from back in the day at Georgetown ISD in Texas, who spent a couple of days simply shadowing one of his students when he was new to the job and he wanted to see what it was like. And he said it was terrifying to see how long that student went without being recognized and with no one talking to him. And sadly, we know that that's all too common in many of our larger schools. And so the attraction to these smaller environments is the intimacy of a smaller group that really you can't go unnoticed, and the support is there. And so I wonder if, despite the drawback, potential drawback for some people, of not having as huge of a community, if the benefit of having real community might outweigh the drawback. And then the third ingredient or pillar for a micro school or one room schoolhouse is the instructional piece itself. So learning the curriculum, being taught the curriculum. And that really was the most difficult part of trying to use one room schoolhouses indefinitely to educate the world, is that finding a superhuman teacher who could go into that one-room schoolhouse and attend to the varying levels, academic abilities of the mixed-age cohorts, ranging from, often cases, from 6-year-old up to 18-year-olds, was a hard task, really an impossible task. And so when the school bus was invented and we had the option of sending students to places where there could be a lot of teachers and more levels, it made a lot of sense. The big change today is the disruptive innovation of online learning and AI-powered adaptive software. With the advent of that technology, we now have a way for students to learn at the right level for them in a highly personalized way, even in a mixed-age cohort. And that is revolutionary. So instead of students needing to go by bus to get the lecture, they can use their laptops to get the instruction that they need right from their own desk in a micro school. Extraordinary, powerful, life-changing for the future of education. And so that really reversed the problem of how do you have an abundance of options with highly skilled instruction for students. Instead of needing to send the students to where those teachers were teaching, we now can bring that instruction right to the students through computer-based learning. And that's an extraordinary advent in our world. And really what it does is it corrects the biggest flaw of the one-room schoolhouse. So now you can snap AI-based adaptive software into a small facility and not only differentiate instruction like Rhonda did in her story, but do it even better. Because like she said, it was so tiring and it was hard to try to differentiate for each of those clusters of students. But now we don't even need a teacher who's able to do that, because our software can differentiate in a more specific and precise way than any human teacher ever could. If it were just the software alone, that might be unattractive. But if you combine the software with a warm, loving, supportive, small environment that also happens to be safe and close to home, you're starting to see the attraction. That is why many families and societies are starting to gravitate to the micro school and the hyper local neighborhood school, a neighborhood school on every block. And the idea is gathering together with other families and bringing in an adult who can love, support, help launch the academic learning, help launch the projects, but doesn't necessarily need to be the one in the front of the classroom leading anymore. And that gets us back to our story of guides. One of the reasons that teachers who start teaching in these environments prefer to be called guides is because that's more of what they're doing. They're guiding as the students are going through their academics on their own, using independent work that's assisted by technology. And then as the students are exploring and doing field trips and learning sports and all of those things together with the guides supporting them. The implication for school districts is that this is a trend that's worth paying attention to, particularly as the school choice movement gains steam. There's more and more reason to believe that families will exercise their right to walk to a micro school if that seems to be a superior option for their children. So school districts are well advised to start creating their own micro schools that follow some of the same behaviors, a guide instead of a teacher who is delivering the instruction. The support, the mixed age cohort, that more nurturing environment, the smallness, the safety, the hyper local, those are the things for school districts to be thinking about and starting to innovate towards. And then meanwhile, if you're an entrepreneur, a parent, or a teacher who resonates with Miss Rhonda, you have the opportunity to start your own micro school. And you don't even have to have all the subject expertise in every subject, be able to speak every language, be able to teach every math fact, because the academic instructional piece you can delegate to computer-based online learning while you bring in the humanity and you set up the physical environment for success. I hope you enjoyed this interview today. If you would like to download a freebie, we have posted in the show notes a simple budget to show you the rough costs of putting together your own micro school. So go to the show notes and feel free to download that and get a sense of the income potential that could be yours if you were to start a micro school, or if you were in a district and were thinking about disrupting yourself by setting up some learning pods or micro schools, the type of budget that it would take. And that's the lecture on learning for today. Thank you so much for joining me. I'll see you next time.
Education is changing, and you can lead the way. The Guide School Kickoff Course trains teachers to become AI-powered guides in flexible, student-led classrooms. Empower your students and transform your role. Start now at guide.school/kickoff. See you there.